This is file 29. This is Jean McMillan. I'm interviewing John Pogue. Today's date is June 7th, 2016. We'll start with the genealogical information, and then he's going to talk about how he came to the area, his purchase and work in the powerhouse in Taconic, Connecticut. Then he's going to talk about becoming the Grove manager for about 11 years, and we'll end up with Habitat for Humanity and all of the wonderful projects that they've been doing since the local chapter got started. So we'll start with the genealogical stuff. What is your name?
John Pogue.
And your birth date?
Must I? It's
April. You don't have to. You don't have to.
I don't mind. April 26, 1936.
And where were you born?
Neuchâtel, New York.
Your parents' names?
Webster and Ann.
With an E?
Yeah, it's actually Annie, A-N-N-I-E.
Oh, Annie, okay. Brothers or sisters?
Yes, I have a twin brother, George, and three sisters, Mary, Isabel, and Ruth.
And what is your educational background after high school?
I went to Michigan State University after a couple years at Niagara University and completed a master's degree at Syracuse University, an MBA in finance.
Oh, my. Did you do anything with hotel management?
Only part-time, more in the lower echelon.
I know what that's like. You have a wonderful story about how you came to the area.
Well, there's a couple aspects to it. One, my folks rented a cottage on Lake Garfield in Monterey, Massachusetts in the 40s and 50s. And in fact, when we drove up here from Neuchâtel or Pelham, we went right through the center of Lakeville in Salisbury, and I have kind of vivid recollections of all the elm trees canopying the streets, and the railroad trestle down where the Patco station is now. So I had a familiarity about the area, and then after I got married and lived in New York City. My wife and I developed an interest in skiing, and especially skiing in Vermont, and thought it would be handy if we had kind of a halfway place to rest overnight on Friday coming up and then proceed on Saturday up to Vermont. But as it turned out, with the being new homeowners and sprucing up the place, we used most of our vacation and weekend time doing mundane projects like that, and foregoing the skiing, although we did end up with a season pass at Catamount for a few years.
So good.
We ski locally.
Well, that's fine, too. When did you buy the powerhouse?
It was in, I think, the spring of 1968.
And there was another wonderful story about looking for houses.
Well, we had a family friend who lived in this area, John Mulville, and he was associated with Al and Ginny Borden. And we looked extensively over in New York State and up in Massachusetts, and not too much down here, but I have a case of claustrophobia, and one of the houses we looked in had extremely low ceilings, 7 feet. Otherwise, the house was fine, and I told that to John Mulvaughn. He filed that away in his mind, and then about 3 days later, he called us and said, "John, I have the perfect spot for you. It has 28-foot ceilings."
Oh, Lord. You didn't have claustrophobia in that house, I wouldn't
think. No. A little difficult to heat.
Oh, I would think so. Do you remember who you bought it from?
Well, I think Mrs. and Mr. Lewis owned it for a long time, and then there was a woman, Scazzari, I think, who bought it, and I think she used it more as a rental property than a residence for herself. I think she lived in Brooklyn and had the property rented out, but it never got really fully up to where its potential.
Where it should be.
She was kind of an absentee landlady.
What are some of the things that you did to upgrade the property?
Well, we did some work on the outside. There were some trees that kind of hid the property, and a telephone pole, and I guess an oil tank in the front yard. There was a fence that was around it, and it was kind of hidden. And it's really a jewel of a building, and it's kind of a shame it was kind of tucked away the way it was. So that's what we did outside. And inside, it had one existing loft on the main floor, and we constructed another one on the opposite end. We adopted two boys early in the 1970s, and the building actually was really... It was a powerhouse for the Scoville Estate. But it was never built to serve as a residence. In fact, it was a garage for trucks and things in the 20s. But so it wasn't made as a residence. So we had to.
You had to create a home out of a shell.
Right. We had basically it was a shell with high ceilings. So we had two lofts and kitchen and some bathroom. And,
to do some wiring and heating.
It wasn't, I guess they just had a kind of a wood stove heating initially. So we had to put in central heating and, change the wiring around. Quite an extensive conversion.
It was, but the pictures that you have shown me, it was a beautifully, beautifully done conversion.
Thank you.
And I would think that the boys would have enjoyed living in something as unique as that.
They did. It was, another interesting, being a powerhouse, it drew water off of the Twin Lakes. And there was a stream on the other end of the building to discharge the water. And so the boys had a little swimming hole and could wade around and even do a little occasional fishing.
Oh, my word. Oh, lovely. When did you sell it?
It was approximately 1980. So we were in there about 12 years. Mostly full time.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and I remember Kevin coming to Salisbury Central, but I don't remember the other boy.
Brian, who's a couple of years younger, he went to Salisbury Central.
But I may have switched grades. Right. After you sold the powerhouse, then you became the Grove manager?
Yeah, almost. It was pretty much about the same time. We sold the house, and I think it was 1981, and I think it was either 81 or 82. I was offered the position as to manage the Town Grove in Salisbury, Lakeville.
Who was the...
Well, Frank Markey was the manager for...
Okay.
I think the original manager, and that started probably around 1950.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, from what I've got.
He left probably in the late 1970s. Jim Rutledge was the manager for a couple of years. I succeeded him.
About 1982, I think, according to the article that you gave me.
Right.
Now I'm going to put you on the spot. In the newspaper article that you gave me, mm-hmm. you mentioned specifically things that you did when you were Grove manager.
Right. Well, I was influenced. I had a chance to learn a little bit about the history of this wonderful facility, and especially the role that Ben Belcher played in getting the town to take it over, mm-hmm. and kind of a bequest to the town. And he had specific ideas about how the Grove should be managed and who should benefit. And he emphasized his wish that the emphasis lie on providing a place for the children mm-hmm. in the town, so a safe place to recreate. So that was kind of in the back of my mind, and it influenced one or two decisions, and one that at the Grove there's a little canteen type mm-hmm. building, mm-hmm. and they sell things like cigarettes and adult products, and I convinced the town that it was probably not a good idea with children around to promote products like smoking.
Excellent.
And then I guess I'd had, I don't know whether maybe it had something to do with the way they the swim area was set up.
Yeah.
And we changed the playground equipment, and that was updated substantially during my tenure. So I tried to put my words with my actions where my words were.
The one thing that I read that I thought was particularly good was separating the children's pedestrian walk and mm-hmm, bicycle walk mm-hmm. from car traffic.
Right.
I thought that was a wonderful idea.
Yeah, it was quite a potential for danger there. And young kids can be unpredictable. And
oh, yes. But, of course, at that time there was more traffic than mm-hmm. would have been in the 50s.
Right.
And I know from some of the mm-hmm. orals that I've done, the kids would come with a babysitter, or my mother would come with a flock of kids, and it really was a very safe place for them to be. You would probably increase your staff to some extent?
Yes, I think we expanded the hours of the lifeguards, and of course, the Grove was kind of the spot for the Salisbury Recreation Program.
Mm-hmm,
for the swim meets and other activities.
Did they have canoeing and kayaking and all of that sort of thing then?
Yes, there's quite a bit of canoeing and quite a bit of sailing. Kayaking wasn't very popular at all at the time, but
that came in later.
I think it is now, yeah.
And the problems that you mentioned of the 80s when you were dealing with it, noise?
Yes, noise. And maybe by diverting traffic a little bit, it helped. The 80s was kind of an unusual time in this area with a kind of recognition from people outside the area of its benefits and posh or chicness, and it was in its time. It was kind of the Hamptons of
mm-hmm. yeah.
of the area, and there were a lot of real estate, price escalation, a lot of new faces coming into the area,
mm.
and a lot more use of the Grove.
Did you increase the fee for the use of the lake?
It was increased, modestly. I think when I took over, it was maybe $2.50 a year, I think, for a sticker, and it probably went up to $5. It was.
Do you know how much it is now?
I think it's probably close to $175, or I know the...
100 or...
Well, one thing I think I mentioned the... There's with the increase in population or attraction and increased usage, and there was a real desire for people that lived outside of the area to use the grove, since it was probably a superior recreation spot, and there were more and more people that lived at that owned property outside of Lakeville and wanted to use the property, and the policy was that the town, for the most part, was owned the grove for the benefit of the town taxpayers, which supported it. So outsiders were discouraged, and actually they could not buy a season pass.
Oh.
They could come in as guests of residents, and that put pressure on the management to kind of play the heavy at the gate. Subsequently, shortly after I left, I think that the town, recognizing the tension, but also the potential. For increased revenue, made the decision. I wasn't part of that decision making, and I wasn't sure exactly what factors came into play. But I would suspect that they decided if they offered people out of town a season pass at a substantial, premium, they could benefit.
It would release the tension, and it would make...
And I think it turned out very well. I think the town does charge, pretty penny, yeah.
And, it's worth it.
Yeah.
You have a safe place for children. You mm-hmm. have boating and fishing. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They're in a very clean environment, even though we do have... weeds in the lake, but it's still a clean environment.
Right.
Were you managing the grove when they would do the fishing season that started in April?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
So you had the boat rental and all of that stuff, too?
Yeah, basically a year-round position, yeah. Yeah, the getting things ready in the early part of the year... The town had, at the time, had a fleet of wooden fishing boats, which required considerable maintenance. That was something we did early in the year, and then mm-hmm. getting the docks and mm-hmm. the boats and everything ship shape, so to speak.
Oh yes, Jim Rutledge waxed eloquent about Frank Markey and the boat refurbishing,
right.
and how he was trained to refurbish the boats.
Yeah, right.
But you got smart, and you got different boats.
Well, we did start to slowly integrate the fleet with aluminum boats, which required almost no maintenance.
Oh, you are a wise man. Oh.
I think some of the old-time fishermen...
We're unhappy?
Abhorred that decision.
Oh, well. Who took over from you?
Stacy Dodge, who was a lifeguard under me and before my arrival, took over. It was around 1992, mm-hmm. 93, yep. or early 1990s.
And she's still there.
Yeah, she's well suited for the position.
Oh, I almost fell off my chair. I went to do an oral on her, and of course, I hadn't seen her since she was in my sixth grade. And I said, "Stacy, how long have you been here?" And she told me, and I said, "Oh my Lord, oh my!" Before we go on to habitat, is there anything else you'd like to add about the grove?
I think you pretty much covered it. It was an honor to be there, and it was very enjoyable to see the children have fun and meet some of the new faces come to town.
And it's still going strong, and it's just an absolutely wonderful, wonderful place. Now you're going to talk to me about Habitat for Humanity. How did you get involved in that?
Well, I lived in Manhattan with my wife in the 1960s, and we were involved in a few projects, and one project that attracted me was kind of assisting tenants that were being taken advantage of. There's circumstances of other landlords. And there was one organization organized called Adopt a Building. And they had buildings picked out for kind of designated in downtrodden areas. Lower East Side and parts of Brooklyn and the Bronx, and we worked when there were, you know, safety problems or living problems. We tried. The tenants felt kind of helpless, and we were kind of an advocate for them, and putting pressure on the landlords
to do what they're supposed to do.
Yeah, right. Kind of to toe the. Put their feet to the fire.
Well,
they've marked the.
Yeah.
Whatever the expression is, toe to the line.
Well, then, when you came up here,
there was a one or two people that were connected with Habitat Humanity outside of the area, which had connections here and. Came up and talked to basically some of the church leaders at first. Dick Tabor at the United Congregational Church was one of the first people to be approached, and Charles Bevins at the St. John's Episcopal. And they called a kind of a public meeting about 1990, and the concept of Habitat for Humanity was presented. And it was very well received. Salisbury had made some initial efforts to provide affordable housing, you know, before Habitat for Humanity.
Oh, good.
In fact, there are two or three groups that were in existence and still are, mostly providing rental homes. Habitat has a different concept with it, where the people that are we call them partners, the owners of the homes, do actually have the home and some equity in the home, and it's not a straight rental situation.
It's more of a partnership then.
Right, right.
Now Habitat is nationwide, and this is an affiliation chapter?
Yes, actually it's a large international organization. Has affiliates all over the world, mostly in developing countries, Latin America, Central America, and Eastern Europe, and in Asia too, in Indonesia. They've been in existence for probably around 35 years. I think they started in 1976. And Jimmy Carter was one of the early individuals that gave the organization a big push. It started in this country in rural Georgia. And
he's the only name that I can connect with.
Yes. Actually, the founder was Millard Fuller, was a lawyer who, a successful lawyer, probably about the age of 30, decided there was more to life
than money?
Than making money. And he went and looked into other efforts, international efforts that have been made. Came back to this country and eventually hooked up with Jimmy Carter.
With the local affiliation. Are you a dues-paying group, or do you just volunteer?
We're all volunteers. We do have some part-time person, you know, office manager and some of the building supervisors get a stipend. Probably 95% of the people that volunteer their time.
Do you raise money?
Oh yeah, absolutely, because Habitat raises the money to build the properties, and then they hold the mortgage, and so the people that live in a Habitat home has the flexibility. Well, first of all, it's a Christian organization. One of the tenets is that there's no interest charge, no usury involved, and so the mortgage can be very, you know, reasonable.
Mm.
And nowadays, of course, since we started, and we're right now celebrating our 25th anniversary, the cost of building a home has increased substantially.
Oh, yes.
And but a homeowner can live in a Habitat home, have his mortgage, insurance, and taxes paid for something around $800 or $900 a month, which is less than a rental would be, and would have a bigger place and have a vested interest in the property and security.
How do you raise your money?
Well, mostly in kind of small events. We initially had a high tea at the White Hart Inn, and a luau at the Interlaken Inn.
Oh, I missed that.
Some nice people offered their homes for dinner parties. And then we kind of branched out into wine tastings. We had many of those, and those were kind of a fun event and successful. And one of our biggest events is the annual tag sale at Hoska School, which we run in the summertime, and we've run those for every year that we've been in existence. So,
really,
we're getting ready for our 25th. And about 10 years ago, we got involved in a year-round retail operation. Basically in Canaan, and we just rent a large facility on Route 7, and it's turning out to be one of our biggest, you know, sort of revenue sources.
Ah. Is that where Judy Moore works?
Right, yeah.
Is she business manager of that?
She's the store manager,
okay.
And she's also pretty much runs the tag sale along with myself.
Those are big endeavors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have as many as 50 or 60 volunteers working for getting ready for that.
But isn't it marvelous that the area that you live in that needs affordable housing, and there are so many people that are willing to help make this come into fruition.
Yeah, it is a nice...
It's a wonderful area.
Fortunate convergence of interest there.
It certainly is. Do you have a board that oversees this?
Yes, there's a board, and which meets monthly, and there's various committees. Not all the committee members are on the board, but naturally, the building committee is probably one of the most important efforts besides the fundraising.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a certain amount of there's quite a bit of administrative work, and
I would imagine that there'd be some criteria for selecting the people that get these homes.
Oh yeah, absolutely. To start a Habitat affiliate, you have to be approved by the international group, and there was some question when we applied for a chapter they question whether the need actually existed in this part of the...
Yeah.
No one realized there was a certain amount of hidden poverty out there.
Oh, yeah.
Quite a bit. So that's one of the things. But as far as family selection, we really target, families that have good income, good credit history, but don't have the resources to qualify for an existing mortgage. Mm-hmm. They could lack the down payment part of it, or their income was not quite adequate to meet the mortgage. But since our mortgages don't entail any interest,
it makes it a lot easier.
Opens up the door for a lot more people.
What kind of salary are you looking for a yearly?
There's a cap. I think it's like 60% of the average income would be the. Couldn't exceed that income. Presumably, those people could get an existing mortgage.
Well, I think you said something like between 30 and 40.
Yeah, it works out, and we. Most housing groups try to have their housing costs equal about a third of their income. So, with the carrying costs of, let's say, $10,000 or $12,000, would kind of translate to a $36,000 income. So that's kind of what we're hoping for.
And they also have to actually...
Since they don't put up the down payment in cash, they have what we call sweat equity.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They have to put in 400 hours of work on their house. They can get some help from family members.
But they really have to do something. I mean, they just can't sit on their tush and wait.
Right. So it's,
one
of the slogans is Habitat is a... Hands up, not a hand. Hands out.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah, it is kind of catchy.
But
it says a lot that they have to be part of the process. That's one of the things besides the financial thing. We want them to really buy into the program and to appreciate what they have and to be part of the.
Well, if you work at something, you own it.
Right.
If it's given to you, it's not the same
mm-hmm.
thing.
Right. True.
Are there any health requirements or safety issues that you pay attention to?
But as far as our new homes go?
The families in the new homes.
Yes, the Habitat homes go through the normal municipal, building code mm-hmm. problems. We try to match the home to the recipient as much as we can. Habitat, besides building, has been involved in a repair program mostly for elderly citizens, and that focuses quite a bit on safety issues. People that have lived in their homes for a good part of their lives and their income hasn't been sufficient to maintain the buildings. Leaky roofs and mold problems.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they get to a point where they need a handicap access, we've been able to provide that.
Oh, good.
Yeah, one of the, and speaking of safety, and when we select a family besides their financial situation and their willingness to participate, we look at their existing home, how many people are living in the house, whether it is safe, and we try to get those people out of that unsafe, unsavory situation
into something better.
You know, substantial and safe.
How many clients apply per year?
Oh, it varies. Sometimes the average could be maybe 6 to 10 or 6 to 12. Unfortunately, it's we're getting probably less applicants now than we did 20 years ago because the shift in the demographics, the rental situation has gotten to a point where a lot of young folks can no longer live here.
Mm-mm. Oh, no.
So they're...
And that makes it difficult.
They're over in New York State or in Torrington or Winstead. Yeah, so there seems to be less applicants.
What are some of the projects that you've completed?
Well, our chapter takes in six towns, Salisbury, Lakeville, and then Sharon, Cornwall, Norfolk, Cayman. Basically, the Region 1 school district. So it's kind of our area. And fortunately, we've been able to build homes in every... We're building in Cayman, in Sharon right now.
Oh.
And that's the last of the six towns that are... We've finally managed to put a footprint down in Sharon.
Do you actually buy the land first?
Well, fortunately, about half of our sites have been donated to us or... purchase at below market rates.
Good. That makes
so,
it.
So that, we've been very fortunate in that regard. Since land costs are so valuable up here.
Is there anything about habitat that I haven't asked you that I should have?
No, I think, I mean, the reason I got interested in it, I did have a background, and the idea that it was a Christian organization was appealing, and it's also kind of an ecumenical, a lot of churches and organizations and good people getting together to do it, and besides offering the interest-free mortgage, Habitat is pledged to tithe 10% of their income to third world countries.
That surprised me.
It kind of broadens the impact of the organization, and I found that appealing, very appealing.
Thank you so much.
Okay.
I appreciate this
very
much.
So we covered everything, huh?